And I want to welcome students who are with us. We have the Valley Christian High School. Would those students please stand? Welcome to our court. I should say welcome to your court. Please be seated. We have the Albany High School. Would those students please rise? And thank you for coming today. Please be seated. The Valley Christian High School and the Albany High School, as well as the Reedsburg High School Equivalency Diploma Program and the Basketball High School students are with us today on the Court with Class program. This program is a national award-winning program sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. And we invite each year students from all the high schools in the state to come and join us for an oral argument. The students are provided with materials about the case that we are there to hear. And at noon, they meet with a justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court who will discuss with them the procedures of the court. And anyone who is in attendance who wishes to stay for the noon presentation is welcome to do so. After we've met you, I'd like to introduce the court to you all. Seated on the far right is an empty chair. And in that chair is usually Justice David Prosser. Justice Prosser will not be participating in this case that we're about to hear. So we will move from the empty chair to Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley will substitute for me today at the noon presentation because, as you will soon hear, I have a bad cold and am reduced to coughing. I do not wish to infect all of the guests today. I am limiting my infection to my colleagues. Next to me at my immediate right is Justice William Bablich. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox, and to his left, Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left, Justice Diane Sykes. With those introductions made, I'll move to the case 99-2446, State ex rel William Marbury versus Philip Macht. This case has been before us before, and representing the state of Wisconsin is Assistant Attorney General Margaret Moeller. Ms. Moeller.
Thank you. May it please the court. This matter is here on the Department of Health and Family Services petition to review a decision of the Court of Appeals for District 2, which reversed the order of the Winnebago County Circuit Court denying Marbury's petition for a writ of habeas corpus. The primary issue before this court is whether the Court of Appeals erred in ruling that release via a writ of habeas corpus was the proper remedy for the department's failure to conduct a timely re-examination of Marbury's mental condition under WISSTAT section 980.07 subsection 1. As this court is well aware, this case has been going on since June of 1999 when Marbury filed his petition for habeas corpus in the Winnebago County Circuit Court. Since then, the case has been in the Court of Appeals twice. It's been to this court twice. Parties have filed a total of 12 briefs, and this is the third oral argument. So the court is well aware of the facts, which in fact are very sketchy because of the way in which this case came up. Those facts show that Marbury should have received his initial reexamination by January 15th of 1999, but instead that examination was not conducted until June 29th of 2000. In waiting this long to conduct that reexamination, it is indisputable that the department was in violation of the statute and was also in violation of an order entered by Judge Hawley of the Winnebago County Circuit Court on September 9, 1999, which required the department to promptly conduct such an examination. Now, the department recognizes that these facts are very unfavorable and that they put the department and its employees in an unflattering light. But despite these bad facts, the department believes that if this court looks at the law, it will find that the law of habeas corpus is actually on the side of the department. Cases cited in the department's brief in chief, primarily Fuentes and Hager, show that there have to be three prerequisites before a court can issue the extraordinary remedy of a writ of habeas corpus. The petitioner, first of all, has to be restrained of his liberty. And there is no question but that Marbury satisfies this prerequisite. However, the second and third prerequisites, the department contends, were not satisfied by Marbury when he filed his petition for writ of habeas corpus. The second is that the tribunal imposing the restraint either had to lack jurisdiction over the subject or the person, personal or subject matter jurisdiction, or else the restraint had to be contrary to the Constitution. And the third prerequisite has to be that there was no other adequate remedy at law available to the petitioner. Now, in concentrating initially on whether the time limit in 980.07(1) was either directory or mandatory, the parties and the courts considering this issue have really pretty much ignored or been distracted from the law regarding habeas corpus. And as counsel for the department, I take a lot of responsibility for this, that really the bad facts pretty much put the department on the defensive. And immediately we talked about, is this time limit directory? Is this time limit mandatory?
Well, is it mandatory or directory? I mean, I note that the Court of Appeals said mandatory, and that doesn't seem to be an issue in your briefs.
That's right.
You accept the mandatory.
We're accepting that construction. But in looking at these prerequisites, I think it's very important to look particularly at the third prerequisite, that Marbury had no other adequate remedy available in law. Because if you go back...
Counsel, if I may, just for clarification of facts, when you recited the facts, you indicated that the department acknowledges violating the statute and the court order of Judge Hawley. There was also a court order, I believe, of Judge Mosier upon the initial disposition ordering a review within 6 months.
You are correct. That language within that initial commitment order of July, I believe, 15th, 1998, said that the department shall conduct. So the department was also in violation of that initial commitment order. The adequate remedy at law that we believe would have satisfied Marbury was filing a petition for supervised release under 980.08 subsection 1. At the time that Marbury was committed, the statute allowed for the filing of such a petition 6 months after the initial commitment order. So at that point, it would have coincided with the time in which the department was supposed to have conducted a reexamination. And if you look at the actual provision in 980.08(1), it would have given Marbury exactly what he claimed the department had denied him, and that was the reexamination of his mental condition with the possibility of judicial review.
Ms. Moeller, I may not be remembering this correctly, but my understanding was that the department didn't have any facilities for supervised release and wasn't releasing people. Is that true?
When you talk about facilities, I think that's somewhat of a misnomer because supervised release can simply mean placement in the community. It doesn't have to be something necessarily that the department itself owns or...
Were they releasing people under supervised release? And if so, how many?
The record doesn't show, and I really can't tell you. I don't have access to what the situation was back in 1999, that would have been. But you're assuming now that had he filed this petition, that he would have been found a suitable candidate for supervised release. And I think that is somewhat jumping the gun, because the question is, could he have gotten the reexamination of his mental condition? Because that's what he said in his petition for habeas corpus, that he was being deprived of. And under 980.08 sub 1, there are very specific time limits when a petition for supervised release is filed, whether it's pro se or whether it's through an attorney. The committing court has 20 days, and only 20 days, in which to appoint one or more examiners. And that would have gotten an examination, and it wouldn't necessarily have been by an employee of the Department of Health and Family Services. It could have been, but certainly the committing court, had Marbury filed this kind of a petition, would have been free to go to private practitioners and appoint somebody to do that.
Well, under 980.08, there seemed to be, at least under the statute that I'm reading, maybe this was not the statute in effect at the time, two conditions for filing that petition for supervised release. Were they both met? It says, if at least 6 months have elapsed since the initial commitment order was entered, the most recent release petition was denied, or the most recent order for supervised release was revoked.
Those are in the disjunctive, under any of those conditions.
Right.
So 6 months had elapsed from his July 1998 commitment by January 15th, which was when the department was supposed to act under 980.07. At the same time, that also was the time limit that he had in which he could first file a petition for supervised release, which would have automatically forced the committing court, the Dane County Circuit Court, to appoint somebody to examine him within 20 days. And it also would have had the advantage of forcing a judicial hearing under subsection 4 of 980.08. The court without a jury has to hear the petition within 30 days after the court-appointed examiner files the report. In contrast, the statute that the department failed to comply with, 980.07, only has a time limit for when the report of the examiner has to be filed, and that is 30 days after the examination is complete. There's nothing in 980.09 which says when does the committing court have to do this, what's referred to as a paper review under State versus Pollock. When does the committing court have to actually conduct this paper review? There are not specific time guides, timelines. Presumably it would have to be a reasonable time, but there's nothing specific. In contrast, under 980.08, it's very specific, and you're guaranteed a hearing. 980.09, which is what ties into the 980.07 reexamination, does not even guarantee any kind of an evidentiary hearing. So in the department's view, Mr. Marbury had available to him back in January of 1999 a more than adequate remedy at law. Now, I know that Mr. Lang, in his brief, has come back and said, no, this is not adequate, and there are two reasons why. And I would like to address those reasons. One,
Let me interrupt you at this point and ask you, and I almost dread asking this question, but what has happened to Mr. Marbury since the last time you were here? Have there been any periodic reexaminations? Have there been any changes in his status since you were last here?
And I'm going outside the record. I mentioned this in my brief and asked the court to take judicial notice. He has had a second reexamination in January of 2002, just this year. And the report of the examiner, and it's the same examiner who conducted the initial re-exam, Dr. Susan Saxonmeyer, concluded that he was not a fit subject for either supervised release or discharge into the community. Also, and I find this timing kind of curious, since the department filed its brief in chief in this court, a court-appointed examiner, Dr. Lynn Maskell, who had been appointed to do an independent examination of Marbury by Judge Mosier, and her appointment was in February of 2001, I believe. She finally got her report in late August of this year, and she concluded that Marbury does not have a qualifying mental disorder. She says that he does suffer from an antisocial personality disorder, but concludes that that is not a qualifying mental disorder, and she takes issue with Dr. Saxenmeier's conclusion that Marbury suffers from a qualifying paraphilia. So she does not address the whole issue of dangerousness, saying simply that he does not have a mental disorder that qualifies him for commitment.
If you want us to take judicial notice of the former, do you have any objection to this court taking judicial notice of the court-appointed expert who says that the respondent, as I understand what you said, is no longer a proper subject for commitment under 980? Do you have any objection to us taking judicial notice of that?
I think it's in fairness that if you're going to take judicial notice of Dr. Saxenmeier's two reports, both of which are on file in Dane County, then I think you can also take judicial notice of Dr. Maskell's. And in conjunction with this, I think it's interesting to note that even though Marbury has been complaining about the department's dereliction of its duties in conducting the initial reexamination 18 months late, the fact is that when his attorney, or he, got the court to appoint an independent examiner, apparently defense counsel, and I don't say this is Mr. Lang's fault, but he had another attorney, I believe it was Mr. Tompos, in connection with those proceedings, has never made any effort to force Dr. Maskell to get in the independent report. And it wasn't until we filed our brief and pointed out that this appointment had been sitting there for over 18 months and there was no report, suddenly the report appears and concludes that he does not have a qualifying.
Just to follow up on that, do you have any legal authority for the proposition that we can take judicial notice of the contents of such reports? I'm not aware of any legal authority that would allow this court to take judicial notice of that kind of content material, which is obviously subject to factual dispute.
That's correct. I think you're entirely correct that in terms of the factual content of it, there is no case law that I found that says you can look at that. But in terms of knowing the status, in answer to Justice Crook's question, I think that because this file is really, in essence, part of this whole proceeding, that it's permissible to take judicial notice of the fact that these examinations have been conducted, although not necessarily what these conclusions are.
Well, what's the status of the proceeding before the Dane County Court?
I'm not entirely clear as to whether Judge Mosier has ever done the so-called paper review that's required under State versus Pollock. The appointment of Dr. Maskell was in connection with the initial reexamination. Now we have a second report by Dr. Saxenmeier, so I'm not really sure how Judge Mosier intends to handle the fact that the first paper review apparently was not yet done because they were waiting on Dr. Maskell. And now we've got her report, but in the meantime, we have a second 980-07, which was filed by the department's examiner.
If the judge, the court, I should say, determines that accepts this private doctor's report, and that the person is not a proper subject, does that mean release?
Oh, no. What would happen if the court finds that there's probable cause to believe that he is no longer sexually violent, then we go into...
Well, not sexually violent. We said that he's not a subject.
Well, that goes
qualifying
into...
Qualifying mental disorder.
Right. Well, when you talk about somebody being a sexually violent person, my understanding is that one of the so-called elements is that you do have a qualifying mental disorder. So you can find that you're not sexually violent either because you no longer are sexually dangerous, or you don't have the, I mean, you can be a dangerous person, but if you don't have
exactly.
this.
Exactly. Okay. Right. So what if the court makes that finding, then what happens?
Then we would go to a full-fledged evidentiary hearing under 980.09 subsection 2B, in which the state, in the guise, it would be the district attorney's office, I believe, in this case, because that office is the one that handled the initial commitment. The district attorney for Dane County would represent the state and have to prove by clear and convincing evidence that Marbury is still a sexually violent person. So that would mean that the DA's office would have to show that he, in fact, does have a qualifying mental disorder, and that as a result of that mental disorder, he's substantially probable to reoffend. So that's what would happen if Judge Mosier, upon doing this paper review, finds that there is probable cause.
But this is really part of the first review, did you say?
Dr. Maskell's appointment is part of the first review. That's correct. The
department. Isn't that perplexing?
It's very perplexing.
How meaningful was that first review if the court-appointed expert had not filed a report? How could the court make a determination if its own court-ordered expert hadn't filed a paper which the court could review?
It's a very good question, and I don't know what the answer to that is as to why this appointment was made in February and there was apparently no constraint on Dr. Maskell. I looked at the order. It didn't say when she had to have the report in, and one would think that in light of Mr. Marbury's complaint that the department was so derelict in its duty to comply with time limits, that he would have been particularly sensitive to the fact that his own examiner, or I should say the court's own examiner, had not complied either.
Tell you one of the things that bothers me, and this might be more visceral, and so perhaps I shouldn't take this into consideration, and you can, that's why I'm putting it on the table. In reading your brief, I mean, you've acknowledged that the language consistent with what the Court of Appeals has found is mandatory. You fought that in the Court of Appeals, but now you say, okay, they had to do the six-month violation. You acknowledge that the state has violated a court order of Judge Mosier. You acknowledge that the state has violated the court order of Judge Hawley, which says, state, you've got to promptly do it, and nothing was done for 9 months. Then something was done, and apparently now you're telling us it's incomplete. But your position seems to be that it's like a burden shifting, but the respondent in files for supervised release. You know, it's like it's, you know, we may have violated the law, we may have violated two court orders, but it's the respondent's fault. He didn't file for supervisory release. And I hear you saying here it's Mr. Marbury's fault that this doctor didn't get a report in earlier, and then that the judge made a paper review without the benefit of the court's appointed expert.
Okay, I'm not saying
I just, you know, maybe I'm too much of a mother, you know, when I hear, you know, it's always my fault, you know. And that's what you seem to be saying, you know, it's his fault, you know.
What you hear is it's never my fault when you're a mother.
Okay.
We're not saying that Mr. Marbury is at fault. What we are arguing is that habeas corpus is an extraordinary remedy. And Mr. Marbury, through Mr. Lang, decided what kind of an action to bring. He brought a habeas in Winnebago County Circuit Court. He had three prerequisites that had to be satisfied before it would be appropriate under this court's well-established jurisprudence to issue a writ of habeas corpus. And one of those, just one of the three, is that he had no other adequate remedy at law. What the department is saying is that back in January of 1999, he had a very adequate remedy at law for what he was saying he was being deprived of. He was saying he was being deprived of the right to have his mental condition reexamined and the right to have judicial review of his commitment. He would have had both of these had he gone under this other adequate remedy at law. And there's case law cited in our brief which indicates that if you had an appropriate remedy, but you didn't take advantage of it, you can't decide on your own that, well, I like habeas corpus better, that I'm going to go the route of the extraordinary writ. You have to follow whatever other possible remedies you have. And this was available to him. And we're not also saying that it was the fault of Mr. Marbury that Dr. Mescal did not comply. We point that out just simply to show that the department, when it eventually did comply back in July of 2000, other parties in the whole system, I don't want to call it the criminal justice system because it's not, it's the commitment system, apparently fell down on the job somewhere along the way because there's no indication why, after Dr. Saxonmeier filed her report, there was like a 6 or 7 month gap until Dr. Mescal even got appointed. And then when she got appointed, she wasn't, you know, filing her report in a timely fashion. And that was not done until after this was pointed out in our brief. So it's not a matter of saying he was at fault because these things didn't happen. It's a matter of saying one of the important prerequisites is not satisfied. And
well, let me see if I understand your argument.
I think that as I listen to your argument, it would certainly raise some concern that since the defendant raised the issue, I think there must be some obligation upon his part and counsel's to follow through. So although I think you're being quite modest about how you feel about this, I think that it has to be and should be an issue or taken into consideration by the court. So I know that if there's any visceral feelings here, mine would be, well, he sat on his hands and knew that was out there. So.
Well, I certainly think that I would take counsel in the commitment proceedings to task. If you know that your client's entitled to something, it would seem that at some point you tell Judge Mosier, give this doctor a time limit. She has to get the report in by a certain time. You don't wait until opposing counsel points it out in a brief. But going to the second prerequisite.
Let me just understand the state's position. The state's position is that because there was an adequate remedy earlier, this habeas corpus petition should be quashed, right?
That it should be, right. You should.
So we don't have to worry about whether there's a remedy now.
That's correct. That's our primary position because he has since had two reexaminations under 98007, and he has never shown.
No. Your position is not that he's had two remedies. Your position is he had a remedy when he failed to get the 6 month review. He had a remedy to go into court and ask for supervised release.
Right, which he did not do.
Which he did not do. And because he had an adequate remedy, you view that as an adequate remedy. Because he had an adequate remedy at that time, the writ should be quashed.
That's correct.
And it really doesn't matter whether he's ever gotten a review from the department.
That's correct. In terms of habeas corpus,
that's
correct.
Right. And that's what we hear on habeas, right?
That's what we're here on.
And are you going to argue that he also had a remedy for contempt?
I think that is an alternative, but before I address that, I wanted to just briefly say that the second prerequisite I don't think is satisfied either, because this is not a case where the department's dereliction of its duty somehow robbed the committing court, the Dane County Circuit Court, of jurisdiction over the person of Mr. Marbury or over the subject matter of 980. These commitments are indefinite in duration. It's not the same as Chapter 51 or Chapter 55, where the commitment only lasts for either 6 months or a year, and you have to go back in and reapply to have the person's commitment extended. And if you don't do it within the time period, it expires. That's not the situation here.
Well, is it the jurisdiction of the tribunal, or is it the jurisdiction of the department? When they are civil commitment, if you don't do it within the time period, it's not that the court doesn't have jurisdiction over you, it's that the institution doesn't have jurisdiction over you.
Actually, the way the habeas case law reads, it's that the tribunal which issued the restraint, and the tribunal which issued the restraint here is the court, actually, the Dane County Circuit Court. And so what really Marbury is asking this court to find is that because the department violated a statutory duty, that this somehow affected the court's jurisdiction over him.
I have Justice Babbage has a question, and I have another question. How many cases are there now outstanding where the department has not followed the mandatory statutory requirements?
In people who are currently untimely, the answer is zero. They finally got enough people to do the reexaminations, taking, I would say, extraordinary measures to hire LTEs, people working overtime. There are none that are outstanding.
Will that continue no matter what Marbury holds?
I would hope so. I mean, I have no control over the examiners, but I would hope that this status continues. Thank you.
Justice Babbage has a question.
I'll get her on the rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Don Lang appearing on behalf of William Marbury. It's our position today, quite simply, that the requirement of a periodic exam set forth in 980.07 must be construed as mandatory to give effect not only to the plain language of the statute itself, but to, in effect, fulfill the legislature's intent to create a legitimate civil commitment scheme. As a preliminary matter, a couple factual points to make that were raised earlier. In terms of the number of people on supervised release, it's my understanding as of a month ago was 14 out of 228 committed persons.
Out of what, 223 what?
Out of 228 persons who are committed.
228 persons who are committed. How many requested it?
Supervised release? I have no idea.
Okay.
As to the status of the Marbury case, as counsel for the state indicated, Mr. Marbury had finally a report submitted by it was a court-appointed examiner, it wasn't the defense examiner, and Judge Moser 2 weeks ago ordered a final hearing. He found probable cause. So the fact of the matter is that the court determined there was a basis to have a final hearing on whether or not discharge is appropriate. And I should say, the delay here is imponderable to me. It's very frustrating to me, having worked on the case this long. The explanation for it is difficult to find. One of the problems that comes up in these cases is the practical matter. There's only a handful of experts that want to touch these things. Only a limited number of experts who are familiar enough with the ever-changing science. So Dr. Maskell is one of the few people that are available for appointments. And unfortunately, she's overbooked and is chronically behind in getting reports out. Mr. Marbury has been victimized again. But the fact of the matter is, the fact he's been victimized again doesn't change the fact he's already been victimized for a number of years. And the state can't escape responsibility for their failure to comply with the statute by pointing at a subsequent screw-up down the line. Certainly, Mr. Marbury shouldn't be penalized for a series of events beyond his control.
Mr. Lang, just my feeling about it, we're now litigating in the Dane County Court, right?
That's correct.
We're litigating here in the Supreme Court. If we should release him, if the court should find that the remedy was release, what does that practically do? Where are we all?
For him, it means he's discharged. He's released, and proceedings in Dean County would be moot. There'd be no more proceedings. And as I indicated in my brief, I think whatever you do in any other case, Mr. Marbury's facts are just so egregious that he took steps to do something, got a court order, and they still didn't act, that he should be granted release under the provision of the state constitution, which gives this court broad authority to grant relief in circumstances where there is no remedy. But let me turn, I guess, to this new issue that has sort of come up at this stage of the proceedings, and that is that habeas just wasn't even available in the first instance for Mr. Marbury. And I guess I disagree just on a general concept here. Habeas has traditionally been viewed or been available as a remedy when the period of incarceration ceases to be legal. And it's our contention that that's essentially what happened here, is once the department failed to conduct its periodic exam, Mr. Marbury's continued incarceration ceased to be legal. That this periodic exam is a very unique procedure in that it's the gateway, the doorway to all the procedural rights for reviewing a commitment. One of the basic predicates of any commitment is a system of review to assure that, in accordance with due process, the person is confined only so long as they remain mentally ill and dangerous. It's stated several ways that the duration of the commitment must be reasonably related to its purpose. And in fact, in Hendricks, in the 5-4 decision, rejecting the claim that this was a penal-type provision, the sexual predator-type law, they pointed out that, well, it's potentially indefinite, but it really isn't indefinite, because the department each year, or the defendant each year, is entitled to have a court review whether or not the commitment continues to be valid.
Mr. Lang, if we go your way on this case and grant the writ of habeas corpus, what are the implications for other people who did not have the timely periodic exams? Does that mean that everybody else gets released as well?
Good question, and I think it depends how the court wants to address it. I think Mr. Marbury should be released under any circumstances because his facts are so egregious. But for the Mine Run case, how do we deal with it? Well, there are several alternative ways. Frankly, I think if the court makes the rule mandatory so the department does its job, that's the preferable way, to have a clear, bright-line rule, because if there's a rule that's clear, you can be sure the department will follow it. And part of the department's catching up now, I know, is no doubt in response to the fact that the Court of Appeals decided Marbury's case the way they did. So that would be the clearest, cleanest way to do this. Now, what do we do with the past cases? Well, it just strikes me that persons in Mr. Marbury's position shouldn't be penalized because they haven't had their day in court to raise a complaint about the fact they haven't had a periodic exam. And here's one of the troubling things and why it's so important to enforce this requirement. This periodic exam process occurs outside the judicial process. So when this occurs, the defendant, or the patient, I should say, has no attorney at his side or on retainer to represent him. Yet, for this individual, his access to the court and his access to that guaranteed right of review that's available, unless he waives it, must go through the department. It's a troubling sort of fox covering the guarding the henhouse problem, because if they don't do the exam, there is no periodic review. So it's imperative that this exam get done for the defendant to get the kind of review that the legislature anticipated, and which I think the legislature knew was an essential requirement to have a legitimate civil commitment scheme.
Mr. Lang, the Court of Appeals ordered that he be released, correct?
That's correct.
And if this court should order that release, or if this court should vote 3-3 as we did last time, the Court of Appeals order will still be in effect. What does that mean with respect to Mr. Marbury? Can the state do anything to protect the public against this person if, in fact, we assume for the moment, and it's just an assumption I'm making, that he continues to be a dangerous sexual predator?
Well, you caught my qualification. That is an assumption. The whole point of the review being to ascertain whether that still is the fact. In answer to the question, there will be a lot of people who are in Mr. Marbury's position will still be subject to parole review or some type of supervision. Mr. Marbury isn't at that point any longer. His criminal sentence discharged. He would be out.
In fact, there's nothing that the state can do.
Theoretically, he was dangerous enough they could Chapter 51 him. But I don't think he's going to qualify for that. They'll never be able to meet that burden, I don't think, with Mr. Barber. But that's a possibility if he's a drooling, dangerous offender who's crazed and mentally ill. Certainly 51 would be available. For a vast majority of individuals subject to commitments, they'll be subject to parole supervision, and the massive conditions the department wants to place on them, whether it be curfew, home detention, no contact, no relationships, treatment, all the various conditions a department could impose. And if he failed to comply with them, they could revoke him. And if they revoked him, they could get back into the 980 system.
Is there anything in this record to indicate that he is no longer a danger to dangerous sexual predator as he was adjudged to be?
Apart from the Dr. Maskell's report suggesting that he's not. I mean, that's, again, we haven't had the periodic exam to know whether that's the case. Certainly the department's opinion from its expert isn't binding. That's why we have a neutral magistrate.
The doctor, I mean, that's a record we haven't seen. We took judicial notice. Really, it's not before the court. But you're saying that that is the ultimate conclusion, that there's no danger?
That's Dr. Maskell's conclusion. I mean, I find it problematic that we're kind of going to speculate what are in reports that are filed in Dane County. Frankly, this is sort of a smokescreen for what the real problem is, and that is that the report didn't get done, or the exam didn't get done.
I think it's a legitimate concern that Justice Babbage is asking, is that there's a concern of public safety, and we understand the other rights and ramifications, but I was just trying to follow up and see what. So, as a practical matter, there isn't anything that would or could be done.
Apart from the fact he'd be subject to, I think, the registration notification requirements and whatever scrutiny police officers want to maintain consistent with that.
Counsel, you're opposing counsel as an alternative argument. In the brief says, okay, if release is going to be required, then we want it to be only in situations that are similar to the egregious conduct here found with regard to Mr. Marbury. And then the state focuses on the several times the Court of Appeals talked about egregious conduct in this case. And if I recall correctly, the state then in part defines it as, I suppose, similar in time, and where there was a violation of a court order examination. So not just any old missing the examination, but I'm assuming, I don't know if they mean the first order or the second order, because there are two court orders here, but the state wants it to be limited to similarly situated for the egregious conduct in this case. How do you respond to that?
Well, as counsel for Mr. Barber, I'd like to say, well, that's a great distinction. Let's go with that one. The fact of the matter is, Mr. Marbury was fortuitous to have somebody there to file something for him. I don't know about other people that are in comparable positions that have been denied their court review for a prolonged period of time because the department has failed to conduct the exam. And their inability to have filed, some paper writ to get into court should bar those individuals from release. In my brief, I suggested, maybe there's a good cause kind of analysis where the examiner got the flu, got sick, had a car accident and couldn't get there, and so they're a day late or a week late. I mean, do we really mean to, you know, require dismissal in those kind of unforeseen circumstances? And that's a more difficult question. Mr. Marbury's case certainly doesn't fit that kind of scenario. And I suspect there might be others who haven't personally filed something to try to get relief who shouldn't be denied relief because they didn't have the wherewithal to do so.
Mr. Lang, I'd like to stay with just Judge Brown's dissent just a little bit more. It strikes me in this case that there are a lot of interests that should be served, that we'd like to serve. We'd like to get the department to behave, and they obviously haven't, egregiously. We'd like to protect the public, assuming that Mr. Marbury is potentially dangerous and if released without supervision, could do something very, very bad. And we'd also like to make it right with the defendant, because his rights have obviously been great. At least he hasn't been given his what the statutes say he should have. Now, your answer is to make it right with the defendant by releasing him. Now, that probably will serve a deterrent effect on the department in the future. But if, in fact, he's very dangerous, it certainly poses a great problem with the second interest, which is protecting the public. How do you answer that? How do we answer that as judges? Are you, because it sounds to me like you're asking us to blind our eyes to the ultimate consequences of our decision.
Not entirely. Again, with the caveat that we don't know. And one of the problems is when they don't do the exam, we don't know. But the reality is, in part, that is the tough job of being a judge. Primary responsibility is to enforce the Constitution, enforce the laws. I mean, let's face it, no politician or executive is going to get booted out of office or voted out because he's come down hard on sex offenders. The public's just not particularly concerned about them. But the fact of the matter is we have a Constitution, we have laws, and the such as the requirement of periodic review. And the reason we have those are to protect people like Mr. Marbury or everybody else who sends to this institution, that the government isn't permitted to commit people under certain circumstances, but they got to follow the rules. And one of the rules is you have to do these exams and make sure that this person continues to be a danger. Otherwise, you don't get to keep them in custody.
Well, the rule is, Mr. Lang, that they have to do these exams, and they have to do them at a set time. But there's nothing in the law that says what happens when they don't. Now, it's mandatory. The state agrees with that. But there's no remedy set forth in the law. So the question is, what is the remedy? Which is what has been the hang-up in this court. I was surprised at your response to Justice Babbage's question, because it would seem to me that we'd say that he will be released in 30 days unless the state files... petition under Chapter 51 showing that he's dangerous and gets him civilly committed. There are remedies under the state law if the guy is dangerous.
Yeah, there are. And that would be one of them. Certainly the clearest one.
What are the others?
If they wanted to bring such a petition, they certainly can. I just happen to don't think that they're not going to be able to prevail if they do bring
that. That may or may not be, because we don't know what the assumptions here are. But one, to protect the public, which is a very important interest. You agree with that, don't you?
Oh, absolutely.
You live in society?
Oh, absolutely.
You don't have any greater police protection than we do?
No.
Okay. So you want your people safe, your family safe, and you safe?
Absolutely.
So what else can the state do if this guy is a dangerous guy?
Well,
there has to be remedies out there.
The other remedy is the notification laws. The sheriff and police officers can keep a particularly close tab on this guy. Now, for many other offenders, they're going to be subject to other restraints that are far more...
Yeah, you said that, what they were on probation. I'm sorry, parole. There might be those, but that doesn't deal with him. Does he have to register as a sex offender?
I believe he does. I think he qualifies.
The paper shows that 2,900 are missing.
That's correct.
Sex offenders. So that doesn't sound very good. Pardon me?
I heard that this morning.
It sounds like a denial club, doesn't it?
That's the prior case. All right, so you got that. So then the register is one thing. The notification laws, you think those are constitutional so that the sheriff and the police pay special attention to him?
There's nothing to preclude the law enforcement from keeping a close eye on someone.
Okay. And then we've got Chapter 51. What else can the state do?
At this point, obviously, if he commits any law violation, he's back in the system. And
you see, that's not very helpful to the people who get hurt by him. I mean, clearly, if he repeats, they're going to send him away for a long time, right?
That's probably so.
And the statutes provide for long-term commitments, incarceration for sex offenders. Right?
Correct.
But that closes, to use some bad analogies, you're just shutting the door after everything has been taken from the house. So that's not all we have to do is prevent. We're dealing with preventive measures here, not after the fact. Anything else the state can do?
That's about the limitations, as it would be with any other citizen at that point.
Why do you think the state can't prevail under a Chapter 51?
I'm not sure that they'd have the sufficient recent overt act which may be required. Now, there is a provision if a person's in a prison,
right,
that they don't have to prove the recent overt act. It's not clear whether that provision applied.
Well, it does apply,
then perhaps the ability to prevail might be greater.
Mr. Lang, why can't we back up a little bit and talk again about Judge Brown and his opinion from the Court of Appeals? He took the position that there didn't have to be release under these circumstances, that even though the law was mandatory, that there were other remedies. And he specifically talked about mandamus, he talked about contempt, and he talked about the possibility of civil damages. I think either under Chapter 51 or he specifically mentioned 42 U.S.C. 1983. Why are those not adequate remedies here instead of release of someone who at this point at least is still found to be dangerous?
Well, again, I disagree with the premise that he's still found to be dangerous.
Has any court found that he's not dangerous?
No, because they haven't had the hearing that they're supposed to have.
But the last finding that was made was of dangerousness, is it not?
Whatever, 5 years ago or whatever.
What about the January 2002? Wasn't he examined?
Yeah, he's been examined by a state's doctor and by a court-appointed doctor.
Well, what did the state's doctor say?
They concluded he's still in need of confinement.
And why?
Because he hasn't progressed far enough in treatment.
Did they find he was dangerous?
That's the conclusion, yes.
Well, that's what I was... Yeah. Okay.
In terms of these alternative remedies, first, I guess, sort of tying into what the state's talked about, whether supervised release was one of those alternative remedies. And I guess, starting with that one, I don't think it is, and especially at the time that Mr. Marbury supposedly should have invoked this remedy. The notion of having an adequate remedy at law usually speaks of one that is synonymous with the one you're pursuing. You can't pursue habeas, usually if you have a 97406 or direct appeal remedy available that is seeking the same relief that you're trying to attain through the habeas. Or likewise, you can't go to court and seek relief if the administrative procedures give you an avenue for seeking the same relief. Well, supervised release isn't the same relief that's available through the guaranteed review and periodic exam process.
What about the mandamus that Judge Brown, sticking with Justice Crooks, is, he suggested a number of them, and one of them was mandamus, and maybe even jail, contempt. Why are those inadequate?
Those are inadequate. And the problem is the mandamus relief, one is requires the defendant or the petitioner to have the resource and ability to do it. And secondly, he's already lost or had his liberty interest violated for the time it would take to litigate the mandamus to get the court order in the first place. The legislature, in drafting a civil commitment scheme, didn't draft one in that fashion. They put you shall do the exam, and when the exam's done, the report goes to the court, and then you're entitled to review unless you waive it. They didn't say, well, the department shall do an exam, but if they don't, you have to do a habeas relief on your own pro se and convince the court to order it, and then if they do order it, you have to hope the department then does the exam. I mean, that's the extent mandamus is an option. In effect, the way Judge Hawley granted relief in the original habeas action was in the nature of a mandamus remedy. He ordered them to act, and they still didn't act. So, in effect, if Mr. Marbury had sought mandamus relief way back when, he'd have been in the same position he ended up in anyway. It was certainly ineffective to guarantee him the periodic review that the law entitles him to.
And then contempt would be not...
Well, the contempt, I mean, we're still unable to identify who it is who would be held in contempt. In terms of the roster of employees that were at the Wisconsin Resource Center at the time, whether it's the superintendent or the head of the psychiatric department, the social worker in his wing, or the record keeper who maybe lost track of the record in the first place, identifying who's the responsible party to hold in contempt is, to this date, it's been impossible to resolve. But that remedy itself has all the same logistical problems. He has to have the savvy to initiate the action. He'd have the time it took to litigate the action. He'd have the time it took to afford the department the chance to purge. And then he'd have to seek follow-up court action if they don't comply even after a court order. So that remedy in itself is inadequate. It's interesting, in the Watts Chapter 55 context, this court had a chance to examine the right to a periodic exam, and the court concluded, well, you know, it's unreasonable to expect people that are committed to initiate these proceedings. We have an automatic procedure where they're guaranteed review without them having to file something. And that's what the legislature incorporated here. The moving party, the patient, doesn't have to file anything. He just has to refuse to waive his right, and he's supposed to be entitled to have a judicial officer review the case. In the Watts context, the court recognized, well, it's not enough that the staff in its good faith decides he should stay. He's entitled to have a judicial independent person decide this, that the institutions may have independent motives and burdens on them that may taint their judgment. And this is really the same concern we have here. Mr. Marbury is entitled to have an independent person look at this. In terms of the supervised release, that's not synonymous with a review for discharge. Supervised release merely puts you in a lesser placement. And at the time this proceeding was going on, getting access to such a placement was almost impossible. Supervised release would have been a proceeding Mr. Marbury would have to initiate. And as Watts recognizes, as the statute recognizes, he's not required to bring any kind of action. And frankly, it's sort of odd that Mr. Marbury would be have to be prescient enough to know that the department really wasn't going to do its job, even though the statute told him to, and therefore he should have been clever enough to realize that he should be pursuing a remedy he didn't really want in order to get any kind of court review at all. That seems to be an odd way to justify the department's inaction, that Mr. Marbury should be pursuing relief he doesn't really want and to clog up the court with proceedings that he's not really interested in order to get any kind of review whatsoever.
I know your interest is representing your client, and that is correct. In representing your client, he wants out, and I accept that being the remedy you seek. But it seems to me that in interest of the department doing a good job here, and in the interest of the other 240 plus people who are institutionalized, court ought to be looking at broader remedies that might be sure that we keep the number at zero. So that it seems to me you might consider contempt, and it could be from the Secretary of Department of Health and Family Services, because he is theoretically in charge of everybody, and that if they don't obey this mandatory time period, Mr. Leon is before the court with potential of institutionalization. I mean, I think that there may be some other views here. The other possibility would be that publicity. That is, that the department file every month for the public on its website how many institutionalized people have not gotten their mandatory reviews. I mean, they have to be creative. Yeah. I mean, I know that you're interested in your particular client, too, but there must be creative remedies here.
Well, that's what...
That would work.
It strikes me that the one that's most compelling is to have immediate result for the person whose liberty is actually being affected. I mean, all these other contempt and other options, the fact of the matter, they don't solve the problem for the person whose liberty is being denied.
The difficulty with that, of course, and I don't disagree from your standpoint, but it's the safety of the public that the court, or at least we're posing these questions, and to get the attention of the agency, the contempt that's been mentioned by some of the justices certainly would be reasonably effective. If your client is released, and what effect does that have on the agency other than a person is out there? It'll have an effect on the agency only if your client reoffends. And then it'll, you know, if we'll have all the publicity we need to discuss this once again, but that's the issue.
Well, I guess I disagree that that's the only impact of releasing Mr. Marbury, but I mean, I think if you release Mr. Marbury, the message loud and clear that we will respect the rights of people committed, and if you violate your statutory duty, there are consequences. That these people, just because they're unpopular, can't be just kicked around. And if you eventually get a report in a year or two later, that makes it all okay now. It seems to me that to give meaning to the constitutional issue at stake, and that is defendant's liberty interest, that the remedy here has to be release. Now, can there be procedures consistent with that that will accommodate the ebbs and flows that the department may face, whereby they can act in good faith and seek approval for a 30-day extension like we do in juvenile proceedings? When you get to an end of a commitment in a juvenile proceeding, the statute authorizes the state or whoever the government agency is to ask for 30 days to conduct a hearing to extend if you can't conduct it within the one-year time period. And although that's a limited opportunity, it recognizes all these circumstances where depressive events make it impossible for reasons to fit it in within that time period. That would be one exception one could carve.
Mr. Lang, your time is up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Moeller, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
I'd just like to, oh, briefly.
I had a question.
Right, you were saving it for me.
I saved. You say that habeas corpus should not lie here because there are other adequate remedies. It's one of your reasons. And the adequacy of those remedies lies in the statutes, in both of the things that you posit to us. But these are the very same statutes that also promised him a periodic reexamination, which he didn't get. So if I'm Mr. Marbury, or even if I'm sitting on this court, I would certainly question the adequacy of remedies that have heretofore anyway been proven to be unavailing to Mr. Marbury. And that was then going to segue me in, and now it does, into given that position, it seems to me the issue in this case is remedy. And what do we do about this? Is there some way that we can fulfill the interests that some of us on this court have delineated of, you know, public protection, good behavior by the department? You certainly don't want to come back here a fourth time and defend what the indefensible. What can we do short of releasing him that will have that will serve all of these interests?
I think in compromising or accommodating all these interests, first you have to distinguish Mr. Marbury's case from any maybe future litigants. And the fact is, and the department adheres to this position, he did have this adequate remedy in filing a petition for supervised release. What he was saying he was deprived of was the right to get his mental condition reexamined and the right to have a judicial hearing. He could not at that point say that he had the right to supervised release, because that would only flow if he got a favorable examination. And this kind of ties into a question, Justice Babich, that I think you asked Mr. Lang. Is there anything in the record to show that he is no longer dangerous? And Mr. Lang adverted to the report that was filed by Dr. Maskell, which we've gone outside the record to discuss, and I just need to correct something. She never concluded that Marbury is no longer dangerous. She found it was unnecessary to talk about dangerousness because she believed that the antisocial personality disorder that he has is not a qualifying disorder. So there's nothing in the record that shows he's no longer dangerous, and I'm interested to hear, because I hadn't known, that there is a hearing scheduled in front of Judge Mosier, a final hearing, to determine whether or not the Dane County District Attorney can still show that Marbury remains a sexually violent person. And I think it makes sense to let this play out. I don't know the date that it's scheduled for, instead of releasing somebody who we don't know at this point may or may not be dangerous, because that does not accommodate either of the purposes behind Chapter 980, which is to protect the public and to obtain necessary treatment for people like Marbury to make sure that they will not sexually reoffend. We don't know at this point.
Well, with this hearing that is scheduled, is there going to be a finding of dangerousness, and does the judge then have the power to confine him?
My understanding is that at the hearing, and Mr. Lane can jump up and correct me if I'm wrong, the Dane County DA's office will have to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that Marbury is still sexually dangerous, that he still qualifies for commitment under Chapter 980. And then Judge Mosier will make a finding on whether or not the state sustained that burden of proof. If he's still dangerous, he stays in. If the state can't meet its burden of proof, his commitment is ended. It expires.
Well, there can be an appeal from any finding, I assume.
I think that's correct. I'm not sure in terms of the state's right to appeal. I assume we would have that right to appeal. I don't know that we've ever done that in any particular case, but certainly, you know, you'd look at it. It's very difficult when something is done on the basis of an evidentiary finding to get that overturned.
What about going to Chapter 51 with them?
Oh, Chapter 51, this was something that we argued in the Court of Appeals as to whether that was appropriate. Number one, a Chapter 51 proceeding has to be filed by the Corporation Council in the county in which Mr. Marbury would be relocating. So the department cannot on its own instigate a Chapter 51. It would depend on the Corp Council. Nothing, of course, would prevent Mr. Marbury from leaving Wisconsin, which would have its advantages, and in that case, he would not be subject to any kind of a Chapter 51 commitment. We just couldn't, I mean, he would be long gone and able to, if he's still dangerous, prey on citizens of another state. But those are two of the concerns with Chapter 51. Another is you have to show a recent overt act, and that might be very difficult considering that he's been under these institutional constraints since 1995. My time has run out, but
before you sit down, do you have any idea what percentage of the current 980 population received late periodic reexaminations? You said the department's all caught up now.
Right, we're caught up. I couldn't really give you a percentage. I know that at one time I saw a list that had people who were not current for either the initial or the subsequent annual ones, and there was something like 40-some people on the list. But the
about 20%?
40 over 200, that would be about something like 20%. But the time that they were late varied quite a bit. I mean, in some cases it was, you know, a matter of weeks as opposed to a matter of months, so it was they were really all over the board.
Right, but if we, in this case, hold that this time limitation is mandatory and that the only adequate remedy is release, as did the majority in the Court of Appeals, all of those persons would be entitled to the same remedy, at least theoretically?
I don't think so, because the Court of Appeals talked about that release was the only appropriate remedy here because of what it viewed as the egregious facts. So I don't think the Court of Appeals was necessarily saying that anybody who's had a belated re-exam would automatically be released. I don't read their opinion that way, although I think, you know, obviously some litigants would try to put that spin on it.
Sure, we can certainly expect that all of those 40 people would file
for
habeas.
So, thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moeller. Thank you, Mr. Lang, for your argument.